This is Season 3, Episode 13, the season finale of Mastering the RPG, a tabletop RPG podcast all about upping your game. Doesn't matter if you are a game master or player, you'll find advice, ideas, and some strong opinions. Tonight's episode is Your RPG Questions Answered, and goodbye, James. Welcome to Mastering the RPG. Like I said, it's all about maximizing your game, blah, blah, yada, yada, yada. James is leaving. This all does, I'm all about to cry, so I don't care about this introduction. But I am here again, Carl, with my co-host Eric and James. If you want to give us feedback or questions, email gamemaster@masteringtherpg.com. You can check out the site at masteringtherpg.com. So I guess I had to say that anyway, but it's good to be on the mics with everyone, especially you, James. How's things going? Your final hurrah? How's things going?
Yeah, last hurrah. Last time you have to endure my long diatribe. I'm going well, guys. A nice hot day down here in Australia. Lots of games coming up. Even though I might be finishing up here, I'm not finishing up with role-playing, so still many sessions ahead for me this week. In fact, I'm playing on Friday night, which will be a bit of fun. Get to, you know, play my Bard Paladin and whack some stuff with a sword, which will be good. So, no, going very, very well. How about you? How about you guys? How are you going there, Eric?
I've been having long bouts of melancholy with the hole in my heart that was James in this. No. I'm doing good. Weather's nice. I joined a new game. It's actually pretty interesting. High-level D&D. It's actually a beta test for this guy's the writer of this high-level D&D that has really interesting mechanics dealing with, like, time loops and stuff. So just started that up. So that should be, yeah, that should be really interesting, actually. And it's level 15
Fantastic.
Starting, so... Pretty much for me, if it's D&D, I'm like, it has to be high level. Otherwise, I'm not interested at this point. So, yeah, that should be cool.
Interesting. That's cool. For me, I'm just keep working on the campaign that I have now and working on videos. So I've had a couple of things that have torn me away, family things, so I haven't been working as much. Good news is I am going to be running at least 3 events at Gamehole Con coming up. I was... trying to do that under the Savage Worlds PEG banner. They have the Savage Alliance out there in Madison, Wisconsin. So hopefully I'll be able to get into their room and hang out with those folks and have a good time. So I'm looking Nice. Forward to that. So that'll be my first convention this year, probably the only one since, you know, I'm not going to Gen Con. Bummed about that, but, you know, it is what it is. So,
yeah.
All right, so cool. So this episode is all about email and questions that were asked. So we solicited, we have email that we received that I've been holding off, knowing that we were going to have this episode. And we also have questions that folks that we know, forums and things like that we've got some questions that we want to answer. And we appreciate everybody who kind of worked with us and came up with questions. And we appreciate all the email we get. So why don't I jump right into the email? What do you guys say? Ready to go?
Let's do it.
All right. So
let's go.
So the first one's more of a comment than a question. This is from Rob. And Rob says, hello, guys. Listen to the last episode. Now, this is a couple of episodes delayed because I hadn't answered this one right away. But he said, I heard Eric state that Savage Worlds was the best RPG for supers. I agree that Savage Worlds is a blast, but I think he needs to try Champion's Hero System. I will be the first to admit character creation is very crunchy, but you can build anything you can think of or think up, and a lot of books have pre-made powers also to speed it up. After creation, the main game is fairly easy, but as a lot of older systems, there's a bunch of edge cases, etc. So before I talk about the cool stuff found that he also is offering, any thoughts, Eric, about that? I have the hero system and it was so crunchy. I never could understand character creation.
Yeah, I played a little bit of Champions years ago. I mean, part of the reason I like Savage Worlds so much for superheroes is that I already know the Savage Worlds rules so well. It has all the other tools that I like about Savage Worlds. I do think that, I mean, the superhero compendium is similar to Champions. You really can make pretty much anything that you can think of. Some of the problem I have with Champions is that because it's more crunchy, there's some stuff in it where you can kind of you can definitely min-max in it. Where in Savage Worlds, while you can be very strong and it's very swingy, you can never really be like untouchable, I guess, because there's always a way around stuff in Savage Worlds. But yeah, I mean, it's just hard to find groups for champions too. But yeah, it is very cool. I like it. You can do more stuff with it, but that's the main reason, because I already know, you know, Savage Worlds, it's all the other stuff too. So it just makes it easy to also play superheroes along with that.
Yeah, I think my heroes system experience was lower, kind of like Street Champions kind of level. And that was even complicated for me to kind of figure out. And maybe I'm just dumb, but it was complicated enough that it was like, wow, this is tough to build the character I'm looking for. I can build anything, but it was tough for me. So I find the supers in Savage Worlds to be a lot easier for
me. It's just
me
more
to
approachable.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little more approachable for sure.
All right. James, you got any thoughts on that one?
I've got to say the last Hero game I played was probably Heroes Unlimited in, I don't know, 1994 or 5. So wow. No, probably not much for me to weigh into, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Not my jam.
That is definitely not your jam. And so Rob also offered a Cool Stuff Found. He said, have you looked at Story Engine deck of writing prompts? Have not dug too deeply into them as I'm currently running a Savage Pathfinder Rise of the Rune Lords campaign. Woohoo. But they really help me get get my creativity moving along. They help bring up ideas behind the standard tropes. And so we actually, and it mentions keep up the great podcast. I am always excited when one drops. Okay, so thank you so much, Rob. Appreciate that. And I think that storyenginedeck.com is, I looked it up. I tried to find it. I think, James, you did a little research on it. I read a little bit about it.
Yeah,
so what are your thoughts?
I had a little
bit
of a look at it. Yeah, it looks, I don't mind prompts, to be honest. I'm a bit of a lover of random tables, so that kind of, in some ways, this is a different way that you might do a kind of character randomizer or a story randomizer. There's two streams that Story Engine do. One of them is kind of story random, so the plot of an episode or the plot of a campaign, you can kind of put that out with a number of different sub-themes, which I was pretty interested in, to be honest. Like, you know, really be great to kind of get a one-shot going, be great to, you know, start to build some chapters that you might link things in. I actually think that would work quite well. The other one, which I'm probably a little less interested in, is they've got a lot of randomizer world building. So, you know, what's further down the trail? Okay, we've got marsh, then we've got mountain, then we've got, or what are the mechanics and features of a city? What are the mechanics and features of a region? For me, I like to daydream, and so I like to kind of come up with that stuff. And I guess I don't get writer's block as much when it comes to world building. But I think the plot stuff and the story stuff looks really, really good. Storyengine.com, not a sponsor. Looks interesting. Haven't used it. Might order one.
Oh well,
yeah, it's a sleek product for sure. I think the good thing about that too, even to what you're saying, James, is that like sometimes it's even good to get like. I have the same as you. I love coming up with stuff, but like when you use prompts that are like so different than what you would normally think of or like what you would normally go to, that's the kind of strength of it, I would say, too. Mainly, probably for me.
Get you out of the comfort zone a little bit and push it a bit. Yeah,
yeah, just absolutely. Like change the, like just from a totally different direction that you would normally get to. So, yeah, it's a really sleek product. It's really nicely done.
Very cool. All right. Hey, Rob, thanks so much for turning us on to this product and, you know, hopefully others. Get something good from it. So so then moving on, we've got another email came from Jared. Says, hi, Mastering the RPG. I'm looking to run a one-shot in a new system and setting, and I was wondering, if you haven't already addressed this in a previous episode, how does the team approach diving into a completely different RPG? Do you check out the core rules first? How much lore do you explore? Do you just get into the one-shot as fast as possible? And just kind of finishes up by saying, looking forward to the next episode. So that's a great question. I know how I do it. I'm a core rules kind of person to see if it fits the flavor. I really want to understand how the mechanics basically work because I have my favorite systems and it's important that I go, does this thing, so the flavor, does it help with the flavor of the game? Does it make you, is there a reason for these? Like Call of Cthulhu, right? There's the sanity mechanic. Has to be there for the flavor of the game. The Alien RPG, it has these things where you can kind of get more fear going and the mechanics around that to the point where you just go crazy and you can't handle the pressure anymore kind of thing. So it's all about how the mechanics, for me, the core rules, how they approach it, because that's what makes it interesting. The lore is great, but the core system has to support the lore, or at least support what you're trying to, the feeling you're trying to get across. That's me personally. I don't know. What about you guys?
I completely agree. And so I jump into the lore first in some ways. You want to get a sense of the setting. You want to get a sense of the narrative and the kind of types of stories that you want to be telling, I guess. And to find what piques your interest, and that could be a world setting. It could be a whole entirely new system. So grabbing that one piece of, you go, yeah, actually, I'd love to tell a story about this or tell a story in this way, and then totally agree. And then straight to the core mechanics to figure out, can this game do what I think it needs to do, or can it tell the story that I'd like to tell with it and make sure it is? Because otherwise you can just grab the bits of it and use the system you're already using in some ways. You can, it needs to kind of prompt you out of that and make sure that it works. In terms of jumping into a one-shot as fast as possible, absolutely. That's the thing I do when I try out a new system. I find that little nugget of stuff that that you can kind of present in 2 or 3 or 4 hours. That goes through the mechanics that you really are interested in. I'd use Call of Cthulhu all the time, but if you were to do Call of Cthulhu for the first time, you'd probably do a chase, you'd probably do something with the sanity mechanics, you'd probably do a combat, and then that, and hang the RP on top of that. So, one-shot's best way to test the mechanic and try out the narrative. But great question. Really good, Jared. Thank you.
Yeah, I also completely agree. I mean, for me, I would say I don't really get into the lore. I mean, especially if it's like a fantasy game or a science fiction game, like mainly kind of know what it's about. But like James, what you were saying, like if it is something weird and you're like, okay, what's the kind of deal behind this? Then I'll read a little bit. But really, yeah, it's the mechanics are the ones that are going to tell you, is there new stuff in here that's interesting? And also, does it kind of, from a surface read, is it kind of living up to what it's promising, right? Because a lot of games, the mechanics get too in the weeds of the mechanics, and they're just like, well, this is not really needed to kind of deliver on what the promise of this RPG is, right? So I think, yeah, I totally agree with you guys, and I don't think it's worth to get too deep into the lore, though, regardless, because like you want it, like James said, you want to test the waters first, and most of the time, lore is not, it's not going to be that important, really. Like I think, for example, is Candela Obscura, which I think I have a sneaky suspicion that might be what Jared's talking about. And I've now read the rules, and I've looked a little bit at the lore just to be like, okay, well, this is also from a player side. Like I've done a lot more one shots as a player. I've tried a ton of different games, and it's kind of a similar thing. But for a player, you're mostly looking at like how do I create a character, the core mechanics of that, and basic actions, and then a little bit of the lore. Is like, well, how does my character fit in, right? I mean, with Candle Obscura, I wasn't even sure, is this take place in our world? Is it their own world? Oh, okay, it's kind of this Victorian, like, separate deal or whatever. So, yeah, I don't know if I added anything there, but that's my take.
No, I think it came down to what everybody's getting to is enough lore to find out what the hook is, and then the mechanics supporting that flavor and that hook to make... Like, why does these mechanics exist? They exist to support the, what this game is, kind of the tenet, what it's trying to put forward. So very cool. Very nice.
And then the one shot is like the stress test, as James was saying, because, even when you look on paper, oh, this looks really cool, this looks really cool, you're just not going to know how those things actually work together until you actually play the game. I mean, you just can't know. No matter how experienced you are, no matter how good you are, how many games you may have designed, you're just not going to know until you actually get that thing in the field, quote unquote.
Holy crap, so. I have to roll 25 D6s? I didn't even realize that when I was reading through.
And then I have to add this, and then add this. Oh, this is too much. Yeah, exactly.
All right, cool. All right, well, hey, thanks, Jared, for that that email. Really appreciate it. So we have one more email, but I'm going to leave that to the end, and we're going to jump into some of the questions we received. The first one I'll jump to, and I don't have the name on this one, and I'll apologize. Somehow I lost it when I was capturing these, but send me an email and say, hey, you forgot me, and I'll mention it next time. So question is, what is your favorite OSR system? Now, I feel like this one is targeted towards me because I'm not sure if you guys play as much OSR there. But
I've played some, but I definitely don't have a favorite because I just don't like OSR that much. I think. I'm not sure.
I still own second edition Dungeons & Dragons. I just play that. Like, I don't need it.
Well, that counts as OSR. That's old school. Yeah, that's definitely old school.
Yeah.
Well, I think these days there's a couple of them that are from a well-supported and kind of the community is behind them. There's things like Old School Essentials. There's things like BX. There's things like Swords and I forget the other name of it. So there's a lot of those out there, but there's one called Shadow Dark that's got a lot of buzz. It's very classic dungeon delving, deadly resource management. Had a huge Kickstarter. A lot of people talk about it, so that might be something to be interesting. One of my favorites is Dungeon Crawl Classics, which is a very well-supported commercial product. It's got the funnel concept that people really like, where you send in zero-level people and they all die, and the guy who survives is the character you make first level. And so it's got a lot of fun things like that. And magic is dangerous. You know, magic is not an easy thing in this game. So it's really cool. And then if you really want to get back to the old days, I'm an AD&D V1 person, first edition. So not even the improvements that were done in the second edition. That's where Osric, OSRIC, that's really where it comes in. It goes back to the flavor of AD&D and kind of works around those rules. Could be some editing in the book. There's a few places where it's like, oh, I'm not sure what you're trying to tell me here. But then I guess that's what Gary Gygax had in AD&D first edition too. You didn't know what the heck he was talking about. So I guess but otherwise the book is written really well. And I think they're doing another edition that they're actually kickstarting at some point in time to make it even better. So that's my input on it.
The only one that I would throw into the ring is, I mean, if you like Traveler, or Stars Without Number is a good version of Traveler. I don't know if people would say it's straight OSR. It's definitely OSR-ish, right? It's modernized it a lot a bit. I do think it fell apart at high levels a bit, but all the other stuff for it, it definitely is a good version of Traveler. Well, Traveler is definitely old school, right?
The author also created, I believe, Worlds. Or not Worlds, Something Without Numbers, which is a fantasy version of.
Oh, he did a fantasy version of it?
Yeah,
okay.
It might be Worlds.
Yeah,
that might
be good. That might be worth something checking like that. It out. I mean, yeah.
Okay, cool. So, next question. What makes you like or dislike a system? That's interesting. Oh, there's so many things. I'll let you guys.
I think we've touched on this before. I mean, first of all, it has to have a strong voice. What I mean, like, it has to know what it wants to, has to state what it wants to do, and then it has to really be focused on delivering upon that statement. I think a lot of games, if that makes sense, a lot of games try to do too many things or not enough things or just kind of get muddled around, you know, don't have like a clear design doctrine almost.
Yep.
And I think, you know, while we love Savage Worlds, and Savage Worlds is a very like genreless game, most games really will have a clear. But it's trying to do things in a different way, right? It's trying to do like the play experience is the most important thing. But yeah, have a strong voice and have them just have the mechanics to support that, and not like go too crazy with all the extras, right? Like you need enough mechanics to fulfill your promise, I guess. And that to me is the main thing. Of course, I like original. I like original stuff. I like interesting settings. But really, settings are, to me, secondary. I mean, most of the time, I don't like even using, or, you know, you customize a setting anyways, or use your own settings, regardless of what it is. So flavor is important, but it really is that, like, mechanics are really doing justice to the design kind of doctrine. And that goes all the way to, is it a crunchier game? Is it a narrative game? Are you trying to do a mix of that? Are you trying to make this easy on the game master? You know, there's so many things there. And there's also just like getting rid of sacred cows for me is a big thing too. There's so many things that we've hung on to that we don't necessarily need to. And there's much more elegant solutions to some of these more complicated, you know, overly complicated initiative or HP, you know, dealing with like health and stuff like that. Like all those kind of things to me. Some of those I think we need to trim away and kind of shed. So when they kind of simplify certain things and try to find elegant solutions, to me, that's a big plus too. I mean, we could go on and on about this, I'm sure. But what do you think, James? I mean, you probably have a lot to say.
I mean, I'm not a big thing on gimmicky game systems, you know, where we've throw a card into a cup across the hallway and then, you know, just that kind of mechanical stuff doesn't really jam with me too much. I've seen a lot of games around tarot decks and that kind of stuff. That's a bit of an instant put off to me. I hate flash in the pan kind of things that are in the zeitgeist at one time and they'll just throw out an RPG, you know, Oppenheimer RPG coming soon this year. But you know what I mean? Like for a while there, every movie and animated franchise had an RPG together and it was just, they were just all awful. They just never had any coherent rules that kind of put things together, no really great settings, and then there was that kind of whole wave of box sets that were awful. I love simple games. I like the simple settings. You can kind of get a nice sense of the world setting quickly and good mechanics that support it. Same as you. I guess it's very similar to the previous question that we had in the email from Rob. But yeah, similar to you. Not as many gimmicks.
Well, for me, the biggest dislike in a system is if it's disjointed. If it doesn't have a clear core mechanic, you know, like everything is different. You know, you're doing this, it's completely different than I'm talking to you, Shadowrun. Everything has to be completely different in a different system and a different way of doing it.
I agree, Carl.
Absolutely.
Now, there's lore that's awesome, but man, I don't want to play it in the game system.
No.
And I also like games that make the GM prep easy. I just don't have time to be doing a lot of detailed, low-level prep. And that's part of the reason I don't play D&D that much, because I feel like it takes me more time to do it with stat blocks and things like that than something like a Savage Worlds does. Those are like the top two. I think, Eric, you said there's probably a million little things that go into reading a game and going, oh no, this is garbage, or this is awesome.
Yeah.
But those are my big ones. Make my life easier and don't make things too complicated and different. Keep its core, you know.
One of my big dislikes, really big dislikes, is it. Or likes, I guess. But the actual rules, well formatted, well organized, concise, like that to me. And I know that there can be really good games that have horrible rule books, but not having a well organized rule book to me is just like, I will not play that system. And this is like Cyberpunk Red, you know, there's some cool stuff in there, but oh my God, that book is atrocious. Absolutely atrocious, with, you know, similar rules being in totally different sections and things not being labeled properly. And I want a PDF version with bookmarks as well. Like, to me, that is, I will just not even deal with the system if they do not have a well. So if you're writing a system, you know, get a professional editor, to have somebody that knows how to format things and organize, because to me, that's a huge turnoff. And like, when we all want to play so many games now that it's just not worth the time to like have to constantly parse through books, you know, that are not well laid out. So
Good point.
Me, that's the big no.
Any other thoughts on that one? All right. So then, we've got something from Orca, a couple of questions. I'll start with the first one then. What are some simple games to introduce friends and family to TTRPGs with? That's a great
James, I feel
question.
Like you must know some good ones.
There's a couple of rules light ones that I've used and played and really, really enjoyed. I guess it's a bit tricky because these are easy systems for players. So if you've run games before, I guess it's important to have run games before that then make these games simple, if that makes sense. One of the most simple games that I've played recently is a game called Morkborg, which is kind of an apocalyptic, kind of very strange, Mad Max-y kind of weird game. But the rules are so beautiful. They're nice and easy, just a few dice. A simple solution, simple character creation process. You can kind of get a character created and playing in about 20 minutes. Really, really simple and really, really fun. The other one I played this year for the first time was a great game called Die, the Die role-playing game. Again, really simple. It's lots of good free-form kind of character creation and thinking, but it comes down to, you know, you just roll a couple of dice, you need fours and fives, simple mechanics. good to play. And I'm going to put a plug in for my old favorite. I actually think Call of Cthulhu is really easy to play. Percentage dice to see if you succeed or fail. And not many mechanics apart from screaming and dying in horrific ways. So if you're into a horror game, I actually think Call of Cthulhu is really cool. And Polk Cthulhu, great if you want to do an Indiana Jones kind of vibe too. So they're my top three. Morkborg, Die, and Call of Cthulhu. I think they're the easiest ones to start people. Anyone else?
Interesting. I've introduced people to gaming, but primarily through them coming up and through conventions. And, you know, I pretty clear, my family grew up with role-playing games. My kids did. And so they were like, they learned D&D early. And so never really had to do that, introduce family to it. And the rest of my family wouldn't touch a game with a 10-foot pole probably. So I never really had that. So I don't know if I have something to add. I think part of it, though, is what kind of thing are you trying to teach people, right? Because the storytelling games seem to be much lower on mechanics. You know, the Powered by Apocalypse, you know, 2d6 solves everything, and it's very straightforward. Yes. So that's something that if you're, you know, if you want people to kind of come in and, you know, more of that RP kind of thing versus dungeon delving, which would be a whole different system you'd start talking about. Some like a simple old school game or something, not like D&D, but like some of these games that try to keep it simple. Those might be good if you're really talking about dungeon delving. So I guess it depends on the kinds of things that you're bringing. Obviously, I think Savage Worlds is very easy to learn because the core mechanics pretty straightforward.
For sure.
So I don't know, Eric.
There's a lot of options. You could like cut those or make pre-made characters, I think, like you do at conventions, right?
Yeah.
It'd be easy for people to actually run. Yeah, PBATA games, narrative games on their own are probably pretty easy. I would say, though, it depends on the game that you're playing. They have some, like, weird conceptual things, I guess, of, like, the mechanics are even weirder for people who already play tabletop games oftentimes. So that might be a little bit hard. I would say probably the best one for narrative, probably Fate Accelerated, which is a easier version of Fate, which is already kind of an easy narrative game. So as far as narrative games go, I would say Fate Accelerated is probably the best one for introducing new games to people. And then honestly, there's a lot of board games that have a lot of tabletop elements in them, and even some lighter ones. I would say those are probably, I have so many games, oh my God.
Monopoly.
Mice and Mystics, yeah, definitely not Monopoly. Mice and Mystics is a good one. There's definitely ones with like simple, I'm like totally blanking now, but I would like look to board games. There's a lot of narrative board games. There's Arabian Tales, that one, it has a lot of story elements that has some character stuff. I mean, there's just some random board games that kind of introduce some of those concepts. I can't think of them right now, but anyways.
But board games, there's some board games that have RP elements to them that would help bring folks.
NPC cards is a good one for like character improv type things. We did a cool stuff on that before.
And don't forget the starter sets. A lot of games have starter sets. So like Call of Cthulhu, there's a starter set that even simplifies it more, right? And gets to the crux of things quickly. So, nice. So Orca also asks, how do I make an NPC that my players like? Well, now there's a loaded question. We covered it a little bit, I think.
Accidentally.
Here and there. So, yeah.
It's always accidentally. That is for sure.
That's right.
It's always, here's generally, make them have like a weird quirk, probably. Right? I think like if they have some type of affectation, but don't make them be over the top, I think generally that they'll probably like that person. I don't know. I mean, I said the best way probably is to look to like media, like what are your characters that people just love, you know? I don't know. It is such a hard one that we could do like a full episode on this, it is always so accidental.
I've got a couple of bits on this one.
Okay, go on.
There's been a few games there's a few big campaigns that I've run that have required the group to like someone, you know, it's kind of like what one of the big Call of Cthulhu campaigns is about avenging a friend's death. You know, Lost Mines of Phandelver is about, you've got a friend called Gudrun Rockseeker. You need to like this guy. So a lot of campaigns actually set this up for likability. And what I found, there's a couple of things that I do. First one is make them actually useful. I think what puts people off really, really quickly is when you're kind of escorting a civilian, because they just get, they become a drain on the group rather than a bonus to the group. So having someone that actually can hold their own also lets you kind of up the power creep a bit on your game, so that when you've got that person in the group, they can kind of help out, so that you can kind of make things a bit kind of more intense, I guess, if that makes sense. And I always try and have them so that they've got an interesting story of their own. So they've actually got their own agenda that may mean that they leave and rejoin the group at different parts of the campaign, if that makes sense. So that if you've got a clear idea about what this guy's doing and what he wants to achieve, and then you kind of drop them in and out so that you can see the evolution of that achievement, is also been really good. And the last one, which I found really, really interesting, was a couple of years ago, I had a group job interview NPCs that they wanted to work for them. So I shortlisted about 6 different NPCs and put on some crazy accents, and they got to choose which ones they like, which was kind of another way to do it. If you want to be a bit more direct, you put them all in an interviewee's chair and see which one survives. But for me, it's make it interesting and make them useful.
Well, kind of I think the easiest way is to make them a completely unimportant random NPC that they, they don't need to interact with, but for some reason they're just going to flies to honey on that person, and you're going to have to come up with all the story on the fly anyway, because that was just some farmer. Why is this now like the most important person in your life that you want to have come with you on your great adventure? But anyway, that's a little tongue-in-cheek there, but they're really good, really good advice.
We James. Adopt Goblin 3. Yeah, thanks for that, guys. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, I you could also use like little psychological tricks, I too also feel like when, if you get them to do favors for the NPC, that's like there's just a psychological thing there where if you've done a favor for somebody, you're more you're more likely to like them, because you're like, I did a favor for them, so I must like them. So have them do like, set it up to do kind of favors for them, and have them obviously reward them very well. Can be another good little trick. James, I love the one about being confident. Now, they don't always have to be very competent in combat. You can have a like kind of weak wizard, right? That's not good in necessarily combat, but then can like help them get through some type of like big, some type of big obstacle, or, you know, figure a secret out that they've been trying to figure out, or, you know, come up with like interesting magic items for them, like getting the right resources. So they can always have other ways too, to like, to really give something maybe the party's lacking outside of just combat effectiveness.
Or politically helpful or socially helpful. Like there's all of that stuff, but having them be useful and important for the group, it's important. Yeah. And not having them aloof, you know, where I hate that. Where every
have them be
NPC
interested in the party.
And helping, you know, it's kind of, you're allowed to help them.
You could, you can always just have like different NPCs with different personalities and affectations, like I said, and that if you want, you know, they can all kind of lead the party to like the place that you want them to, but whatever one sticks, that's the one that sticks, right? The one that like, they like this one with the floppy hat and the strange accent that smokes cigarillos, you know, that's okay. So he's the one that's going to lead them to the house in the swamp, I guess, because they like him.
I like that. Yeah, that's a good point, though, is sometimes a lot of NPCs kind of appear. Some get latched onto, some don't. And when they do get latched onto, make them useful, make the party want to hang out with them, make a reason that they would be with these people, just like your friends. There's a reason you hang out with your friends. And if you don't like them, then there's no reason you'd hang out with them anyway. So, all right.
And then you get them to love this NPC, and then you kill them off.
Kill them. Yeah, that's it.
Just don't have the try to avoid having the NPC stab them in the back. I mean, that can work once or twice maybe, but I mean, that's just they'll never trust another NPC again.
No, you have a different NPC stab that NPC in the back, so they hate the other NPC.
See, that's fine. That's fine.
There you go.
So, all right. Well, here's a funny one, I think, kind of a fun one. what dice superstitions do you have? What dice superstitions?
Oh, boy.
Well, I
only have dice superstitions as a player. I don't have it as a dungeon master. I only have it as a player.
Yeah.
I've got a lucky dice, a lucky pearl one. Sorry, go, Carl.
No. I was going to say the exact same thing. There's a dice set that's kind of like, this is my dice set that I feel good about it. But as a game master, I like to have dice sets for my different genres if they can be like tailored. Like I do some military games and I have camouflage dice that I use when I'm game mastering those games. I can't always do that. I used to have a set of dice that were kind of look cyberpunkish, but for some reason I can't find those anymore. But so I like to use dice that have kind of a theme, or I feel like this is my dice for this game. But as a player, absolutely, there's a set of green and white dice that I pretty much always use because I really like so much that I use them. That's the color scheme I used for our YouTube channel because I love those dice so much. That's where that color scheme came from. Was from those dice.
All right. See, me, I have to, whenever I buy new dice, I have to have it out in a storm during the full moon just to, like, get all the positive magical energy. And that's where I
bury it under a tree at the height of midnight.
For sure. Occasionally, I might sacrifice a small animal on the, altar, whatever. But, you know, mostly it's just that moon storms.
No, you sacrifice
I have a
an RPG
specific
game.
Pearl.
You burn a book in effigy on
burn
top
a board
of the dice.
Game.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Let's hear about this pearl dice, James.
So I got a pearl dice, and I've had it for 30 years, something like that. And so it's always my lucky backup dice, but I never try and drain the luck of it. So what I do is if I'm failing on something, so like I'm using other dice and it's not going well, then that's when I'll draw on the power of the lucky pearl. And it seems to work. I'm just saying, it seemed to get good rolls out of that dice,
so
and
do
I've
you
had
have
it forever.
A- So
but
you
I
have like a
I
little case
use it.
With felt in it, and then you bring the case out and you open it very slowly. And you pick it out.
Little smoke
it
machine.
It is in a little velvet bag. Single velvet bag, and I do keep that in my top pocket when I play. So yeah, there is a bit of that.
That is so awesome. I love it. I love it. I love it. So nice. Okay, next kind of question we've got going here is. How do you encourage players to take notes?
Rewards. Metacurrency rewards.
Yep. Rewards is always
that's
it.
The, if somebody's not already predilected on their own to take notes, and you know, as a player, I try to take some notes, but I'm never gonna take the notes that are good for everybody else. I can't do it. I have ADHD. It's just not something I can do. But I do try to take some notes. If you don't know somebody that like loves taking notes, then you reward them with metacurrency. It's just that simple. At the beginning, whoever took notes at the beginning of the game, whoever does the recap, you know, for each one, you give them like Carl would give us a Benny, right? Other people might give a hero point for the person who wrote the notes down or the recap, or you give somebody inspiration in D&D. I mean, it's just that is the go-to, right? And if your game doesn't have it, you come up with one. It's, you know, we've talked about it. It's so easy to have a free reroll in a game that has dice, or you have a plus one on anything that you want. I think that's just the... That's the way to go it, right? I don't know. Do you guys have any other?
That's the way to do it.
That's the way to do it. And it can be real.
If it's an IRL game, if you're like, okay, this person gets the cupcake or something, that you know, that's not cool. But everybody deserves a cupcake. But
they don't have to buy pizza this time. They get their slices for free because they took notes. All right,
because you don't want to give somebody. You don't want to be like, okay, this person gets the plus three magic item and other people don't because they take the notes. Like, that's too much, right? It has to be something
that's expendable, not too valuable. You know, valuable, but it's within the game structure. Like you said, inspiration or something like that. It's worth something, but it's not OP. It's not overpowered. Right. And you know, that's... If you find that special someone in your player group that just likes to take notes, then that's a special thing. That's a special thing. So
it really is.
That new game that I joined, there's someone who takes the most in-depth, insane notes I've ever seen. I mean, it's like every session is like a page. And so I'm very impressed that they can do that.
Wow, that is impressive. Double-spaced? Or single spaced?
No, single spaced. I believe it's single spaced. Wow. Yeah, I know.
All right. Cool. All right. So then we got a question. Thanks to Orca for those questions. And now we have a question from John. What are your top hints for helping shy, introverted players come out of their shell, especially in a group of more extroverted players?
Great question.
Psychological.
I,
yeah.
I mean, and you can do this approach as both a game master and a player. I think for me as a game master, the most, I mean, you guys, we've talked about this a lot. When we talk about spotlights, and to really make sure an introverted player gets the spotlight, you know, mine their backstory. And like when there's a situation that is really all about their character, that will set the stage and for them to care more, and that really helps them. And especially if there's players that maybe like to jump in or like to kind of take over at times, or maybe not, it's not their really fault, but if it's really about like this character's aunt is being held up in the tower and they have to talk to their uncle, right? That's going to help them at the very least kind of have their spotlight. And I just going to say, as a player, is going to help this too. I'm sometimes guilty of, you know, I'm a very extroverted person. Most times I get introverted as well, but, you know, I love to act. I love to improv. So I can take the reins if people aren't doing it. But I like to think, and I have done it. I mean, I don't know, not in the game with you, James, because we were with such a good group of players that are very extroverted. But with Carl, I mean, I don't know if you, like, we have some players that all be like, my character will ask them about their backstory. Or my character will like, hey, can you help me with this? So even as, you can do this as a player where you can ask that other person, hey, can you help me because I know that you're good at this? Or what's the deal with like this thing? Like, you know, ask them questions. And I've always found that helps introverted characters come out of their shell more. And as a game master, if you have somebody who is like that, like talk to them privately. Like, hey, can you help me out with this player? Like have your character ask them questions. Like, you know, you can definitely communicate with your players, especially if it's a player that's charismatic or that, you know, is good at improv or that type of stuff or is open to those kind of things to help you out with that. Because I think even more than the GM, another player asking in character, asking their character about their backstory or about something that they have is one of the best ways to get them out of their shell. James, what about you? I mean, sure, you deal with this a lot, right? With
There's a couple of things. It's tricky because you don't want to. For someone who's a little bit more withdrawn, you don't want to put the spotlight glaringly on them either in front of all these extroverts.
That's true.
Because then there's the pressure to perform, you know. So there's a couple of little things you can do. One of the things I do is split the party up into small groups so that you might have – so if, let's say you've got a group of four, split them up into pairs so that then that introverted person isn't necessarily competing against the whole table. But you can then, you know, run some encounters or some interactions with two people. So that makes it a little bit easier to kind of draw someone into the conversation if they're not having to compete with larger kind of talkers. I also tend to focus in the strengths of the character a lot so that you can start to pull some of those out. I've got a very introverted cat burglar character in one of my Call of Cthulhu games. And so you make sure that there are a lot of mechanical things that person can do. So that they're still being drawn into the story, even if it's not socially being drawn into the story, if that makes sense. And lastly, I guess, feel free to chat about it too. Like I've got a great little kid. I think he's amazing. He's playing an introverted bard in one of my Dungeons & Dragons games, which is so against kind of type, but he's actually a really soft-spoken kid. And so he's looking in the composition of bards and the kinds of music that he's preparing. But it's a very introverted way of playing a bard. And so I chat with him a lot about, does he want to perform? How does he, you know, and so it's a more subtle way of drawing someone into the story, which is interesting. And we just chat about, are you up for a performance tonight at the start of the session? No, I don't really feel like it. Okay, cool, we'll just play. And he enjoys playing. And don't forget that some people who are introverted just like watching and being part of it. Then you don't necessarily have to. You don't necessarily have to force everyone to, not force, but you don't, not everyone has to bring the same energy to your table. Often the quieter guys like the game for different reasons. So there's that as well.
Yeah, I think it's why are they introverted with respect to playing? Is it that somebody's stomping all over them and so they don't get a chance to get the spotlight? In that case, you want to make sure you're moving the spotlight around very purposely. If it's really they're just shy and they just are happy to watch other people do stuff, well then, like you said, James, you don't want to, you know, burn them with the red hot sun of the spotlight. Partner them up with somebody who, like you mentioned, splitting the party, but even if it's not splitting the party and it's a matter of like, here's two people that are working together very clean, like they're brothers or they're related in some shape or form, and so they work together, and so there's always a yin and yang. And I think Eric, you've done that in the past, right? You've been like, this is a buddy of mine and I'm drawing them out as I talk to them because we have a shared experience and they can, and we can share discussions in the spotlight because we should, right? Because we're related in some shape or form. So definitely moving the spotlight around. But James, to your point, if the person really doesn't want the spotlight, there's a conversation there. It's like, hey, you don't get a lot of time, you know, other than rolling the dice for your mechanical stuff, which you absolutely want to, like you say, bring that to the table. Their character has skills. Let them use those skills. And then that's part of their spotlight. You don't seem to be, are you enjoying the game? It's like, oh, no, I'm great. I love watching all these other guys do crazy stuff and laughing at it. Great. We can keep doing that. That's perfectly fine. No requirement to do it otherwise. So any last thoughts on that? Great question. Great question,
well, yeah,
John.
Really good. James, what you were saying is absolutely right. I mean, what I was saying was in the context of somebody who wants to get more involved, right? Like, you definitely should be sensitive to people and how they are and not focus on them if that makes them uncomfortable. 100%. Yeah, that's really good advice.
Very cool. So I don't know. Should I say the tag, this tag, and then read the question?
Sure. Okay.
I mean, so there's Squanch Pirate.
You can just like cut out the end number.
Yeah. Okay. We'll get rid of the numbers. So Squanch Pirate.
Okay.
asterisk. Hey, love the show. How do you guys not give away? And that's in quotes, that a combat is going to take place when you have a battle map prepped.
I always have a battle map prepped. That way they can't tell if I've got a combat prepped or not.
Yeah.
I run a combat encounter in every game. Because that's the way I kind of like playing games. So in my table, I just have it when people sit down to start with. There is the map there that's covered over by a cloth. Like a sheet or something like that, and then at some point, we're fighting. But I don't tend to be.
That's IRL.
Yeah, that's how I do it. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm
playing
online. In terms
online,
of digital, it's even easier, isn't it? You hide the map and then you share the map, and that's kind of it.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Online it's easy. There's no map until there's a map, and then nobody knows the map is there until the map shows up. So,
but I think maybe what they're maybe saying too, and something that I've thought about before is that, like, you know, sometimes we. Like, it changes. It's sometimes good to, like, mess with expectations. And I, like, James, what you were saying, like, having a map for everything is also can mess with them, like, even when there's not going to be a combat encounter. Because players, like, even digitally, players, you will play differently. Okay, a map's there. Stuff's going down, right? But stuff might not be going down. And if there's not a map, people play differently. So I think one way to kind of mess with people, not really mess with them, but kind of have them play more organically, even if you have a battle map prepped, is you can still use, like, scene photos, right? Like pictures to help illustrate a scene. And even if you have a battle map prepped for this scene, you can just have that scene picture. So you're like, okay, this is kind of where you're at. You know, you don't always have to have a battle map for, like, well, we're in this forest area now. You don't necessarily have to have a battle map prepped for that, right? Because a fight might not be happening. So you might just have, like, this is kind of what the forest looks like, or this is kind of what, like, the arcane tower in the forest. Here's a picture of it. And then they'll be like, okay. And then you could surprise them. Oh, I actually have a forest arcane tower map as well. Ready to go if you guys kind of did the thing to, like, make combat happen. So, like you said, it is easy, but I think sometimes when you throw down a map into an area, that's going to, like, inform them that, like, oh, combat is a thing that might happen, so we have to be more careful or something. So it's a good thing if you have players that are really like that and are really tuned into that, it might be just good just to, like, always have the scene pictures first, even when you know, to help you with the description of the scene, and then surprise them with a map when they're least expecting it.
Well, I've occasionally used maps that are just really just setting the scene, you know. So the map doesn't mean you're going to have combat. It means that you see what's going on and you have other people you can interact with. We had a couple of those in some of our games where there really wasn't. It was up to you guys whether you decided you wanted to attack people or not. That was up to you. But the map was there just to show kind of the relationship of all the individuals and get you a feel for what's going on. So that's definitely kind of flipping expectations. But,
you don't need to just use maps for combat encounters. I've used them for intricate social encounters, too.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm getting at.
A ballroom, and then you've got to interact with lots of people. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep, very cool. And you know, there's giving away combat it's a role playing game, so it's hard to, you know, we're going into dark forest and bad things are going to happen, and you know what, I'm expecting bad thing to happen, and maybe that things don't happen, and that's where you're usurping the expectations. But chances are you're going to have a combat, and it's going to be given away, so you can't always protect against that anyway. So, all right, well, cool. So then we got Tim Kettle, another asterisk after that one. Here's an interesting one. Top snacks for in real life gaming. Top snacks. What are your top snacks?
Trail mix.
That is Trail a good mix. Choice. Excellent
really?
Choice.
It nutritious, a mix of different flavors, but not going to leave stuff on your hands to get on the components or the maps or the cards or whatever. Accessible, you know. To me, those are top. That's top tier. You know, you don't want chips. You can get too much stuff on your fingers, right? Nothing like popcorn, way too much salt. Nothing like a pizza that's too much grease around my table. No, not dealing with that. To me, it's definitely trail mix.
For fantasy games, it's always pretzels, and for Call of Cthulhu, it's always a lovely smorgasbord of finely prepared cheese and dates and fruits because it's a sophisticated game, and so you do sophisticated stuff.
You use some wine pairing too with that.
Do you sit there and watch people while they're like going and they eat the date, and you go, "Ha ha, I got you. Those were bad dates,
poison dates." But yeah, exactly.
That was the seed of Krumbakuth, the egg-laying psychopath.
I disagree with you on popcorn. Popcorn is a go-to favorite. Just make a big bowl, set it up there. You know, this is a snack, you know, and then there's just so many good snacks that you can have with your game. So
to me, I'm also coming from board gaming, which is like, you know, and you have those long sessions with so many components and pieces. For me, I'm like, I had a nice gaming table. It's like stuff that's just not going to leave a mess on your fingers or leave a mess around the table, like for sure. So
board games and soft cheeses do not mix. Sorry.
And I've never had a fancy gaming table. It's always been a big old folding, like one of those big 6-foot folders kind of things.
Oh, man.
I never had a...
Yeah, I mean, dining room tables, but I had like a nice poker table that I would use for games and for poker, of course. But, you know, I don't want stuff on the... I don't want crumbs on the felt, okay? No crumbs on the felt.
No crumbs on the felt. So, obviously, no chips. Well, wait, trail mix. Doesn't trail mix at the bottom, when you get to the very end...
You put trail mix in cups for people, so they can't. There's no the bottom flips up, right? And the cups house it so they can get their fingers in there without spilling everywhere too. I've gone deep with this. Okay, I've gone deep with this.
You are the entertainer du jour there. So for real life games, and likewise drinking. What would be your go to drink? For your gaming, this is not the question, but this is my question. Go to drink.
No, you can't have a drink on the table. No, I mean, that's more like cup design, I would say, or like closed water bottles, right? You don't want an easily knocked over cup near anything. So
I don't know, vodka over ice. That's your drink of choice for gaming. or
good, all right, just vodka and ice,
a good scotch, you know, something like that. That's what you got to have. So,
I like cider. I would say if we're talking about alcohol while gaming, because it's like, you know, light. It's not too much. I don't want to get too drunk too quickly. So, but I have drank a lot of Moscow Mules while gaming. So I don't know if that counts.
There was a time where we drank mead while gaming because it was kind of very fantasy. Let's drink ale and mead, and it just gets you wrecked. It's not a good way to drink.
Mead gets you so messed up quickly. That's right. It's good, though. Mead is good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. Well, I guess you could have a beer and try to call it as good as you can get without going into that level. So, all right. And then we've got... a question from 11-7, asterisks again. PC versus PC fights. Do you have permanent consequences? Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. I personally don't let the players kill each other in the sense of, you know, you can have fights and bad things can happen, but, you know, it's always... they're down, they're out. I really don't like player versus player where death is... a possibility.
Yeah, I'm the same. I actively discourage PC versus PC during the course of the game. There are some exceptions. Like at the end of a campaign, I love to do a battle royale where you just get to fight each other to see who would win. There's that you could do. There's that, and you could intersperse that with a kind of brawling pit kind of idea if you wanted to. But Honestly, it's just a way to create bad blood if you allow people to go down the path of physically attacking with a permanent consequence. That's when people quit tables, is in my experience. I wouldn't go down that path at all.
Yeah, so I think the answer for you is PC fights can happen, especially if the people are mature enough or the story dictates it, but don't have like permanent consequences as far as, you know, injuries or things being stolen, really, or things like that, right?
Unless the players want that. Yeah. And they say, you know,
unless the players want it. Yeah.
At the end, you know, they say, I got, you know, after our battle, I've got a scar and I'm going to remember that scar and hold a grudge and it's going to be great. Okay, whatever. So that's fine. Yeah, definitely.
And I will do a bit of a shout out and a caveat to Bjorn, who I mind controlled a barbarian who was another player and then killed him earlier this year. That was my fault, not the player's fault. All right, so you know, okay. I can separate that.
He'll apologize now for that mistake.
Yeah,
so all right. So I saved an email for the last, and we'll kind of wrap up with this. And this is from Sean, and it goes: I had to break my long silence to say goodbye to James and to thank him for bringing his perspective to the podcast. The three of you all bring informative and interesting stuff to the podcast every week. But James's point of view is unique in so many ways. Carl and Eric will have to bring on a woman from Europe who has mostly run free league games if they want to match the diversity you've brought to the show in thought. So, well, we tried to get an Australian.
And here's our announcement. Really, here's Olga from.
Yeah. John, yeah, so, here's Olga.
And Sean finishes up saying, thanks again to all three of you. I hope MTRPG keeps going on for many, or keeps going for many more seasons. But that's a good, I mean, we were very diverse. We had an Australian. What more do you want?
From the Phalanx. Really? Yeah, exactly.
We're different time zones. That's how diverse we are.
Their water goes different ways when they flush.
I had to write a macro to calculate the time zone so I would know what the heck time it is over there. So,
oh, did you really?
Of course you did. Carl, of course you did. Carl would write a macro.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Yeah, so go on.
Yeah, come on.
Thank you very much, Sean. That's really lovely to say. Very nice. Sorry, but Carl would write a macro. Carl would write a macro for...
Oh, you know, to eat if he could. I mean, every sure. part of his life would be macro. And where do you think
that little text that says every time I send you saying we're Carl's time 8 p.m. and then it says all your other times?
I thought you just typed it out.
No, that came from macro. yes, that's why. I guess well, that's sort of funny. So, but James, you know, just before I kind of wrap it up, it's been just a wonderful three seasons. Absolutely fantastic. Enjoyed it. I think I've learned so much doing this with you, and some of the, you know, great thoughts and just your perspective and having done games for a long time, having done them for kids, having done them professionally, having, you know, so much material that you've digested and been able to tell the listeners. It's going to be very hard to replace you. I don't think we can replace you. We'll just figure out what we can do to carry on. But I really appreciate it. I got to know you through this. I think I played in one of your games like one time, and then this is how I got to know you. And it was, it's been a great time so far.
Absolutely. I've loved it. I've loved it. Three seasons of being able to talk about two such passionate people, and I guess to talk passionately about it, it's been really, really amazing and great questions from people. Great feedback. It's been really, really cool. I will very much miss being part of it, but won't miss it because I'll be a listener. So I'll be sending through these pesky emails now to try and stump you with some more controversial questions.
I can't believe you let Eric say that. No.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely. Now I'm going to go wild.
And in terms of you two, of course, we'll keep in contact, and I'm sure we'll play games into the years to come. So
I hope so.
But, podcast is going, but the games continue. But thank you so much for having me. I've had an absolute blast.
Absolutely. That was just, I'm saddened. But, you know, we wish you all the great luck. I know you got a lot of busy, your life is busy. You've got a lot of great games you're running for folks that are bringing more and more people into the hobby, which is just fantastic. So, all right. Any final thoughts anyone has before I close it up? All right, well, great questions for everybody who provided them. Great email. Appreciate that. Eric and I will regroup and figure out what our next steps are. But this is the end of season 3. We appreciate everybody listening. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you got something out of it. Remember to drop by masteringtherpg.com to learn about the projects and everything that's going on. Please email gamemaster@masteringtherpg.com if you got questions, some ideas on where we go next, whatever. Just adjudicating differences of opinion, whatever, you know, questions. We love it. If you like the show, please give us a positive review wherever you get your fine podcasts of your choice. We like doing it, and we'll miss James. So for the last time, I'll say once again, this is Carl with Eric and James. Say goodbye, guys.
Goodbye, guys, for the last time.
Good day, guys. That was for James.
Good day.
Good day.
Good day, mate.